hello, dear listeners from around the world. Thank you for tuning in wherever you're from. My name is Henrik, and we are glad to have you with us listening today. Red Ice Radio is the name of this investigative online radio program. Questions is what we ask, and answers is what we seek, no matter where it may lead. We cover everything between heaven and earth, beyond and below. If you want to find out more and listen to more topics and programs, please visit redicecreations.com. Today we have writer, former journalist, artist and musician Ole Dammegård with us to discuss his book Coup d'etat in slow motion, a book that turned out to be a very important but dangerous task for him. In his book, Ole uncovers the real facts behind the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme that took place on the 28th of February 1986 in Stockholm. It has interesting similarities with the JFK assassination. He'll discuss an international conspiracy of what is still claimed to be the deed of a madman, but has turned out to have its roots within the international military complex and world finances at the very highest level, all sanctioned locally from behind impenetrable veils. We'll talk about the life of Olof Palme, the unofficial and the official story, in an effort to try to figure out why he was targeted and what the deeper geopolitical ties are. All right, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Ole. Nice to have you with us. First of all, thank you for joining us all the way from Spain. Good to talk to you today. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. And I feel honored to be with you and the rest of the guys on this website.
Excellent, thank you for that. We have, of course, a very interesting topic ahead of us today, something that I've been interested in for a long time, the murder of Olof Palme, something that happened when I was about 6 years old. I do recall some of the things from the event of where I were at the time and everything surrounding. We're going to get into detail about this, of course, Ole. But first of all, tell us just a little bit about yourself. I want to hear kind of how you got involved in this, how you got interested in this particular murder, if you will. So give us some of the backstory here.
I think it all started when I was a kid. I was born in Denmark, and my family was very much involved in the Danish resistance movement against the German occupation. So my whole life I've been hearing about how to stand up for the truth and how to uncover lies and how important it is to stand up for what is right. And then when I was about your age, when Palme was murdered, I think it was like 5 or 6 or something like that, John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and I remember the shock, the impact it made on my family, and also with the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember when the whole world was sort of afraid of what was going to happen. So it made a real impact on me, these things. Then many years later, I saw, it was the first time I saw the Zapruder film, when I discovered what happened around the Kennedy assassination and how many lies there was involved in that around the official version. So I got, I would say, almost like obsessed trying to find out what the hell had happened there. And so I started reading. I think I read like a couple of hundred books. I was so, so into it. And from the John F. Kennedy assassination, I started getting interested in the assassination of his brother, Robert Kennedy, of Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, and so on. And after a while, I started seeing that it was almost like there was a pattern between these different assassinations, how a group that was ordered to commit the assassination by a very high force, political, economical force, how they could do away with a person like that, how they could get away with it. And I started seeing, like I say, a very clear pattern on how it was done. And after a while I was doing this, the Palme assassination happened. And to start with, I, like everybody else, I thought, oh my God, it's a one lone crazy guy who shot Olof Palme, because that was what everybody was told.
Yeah.
And I thought that the Swedish police were honest, and I thought that thank God I'm in Sweden, where everything is white and pure and clean, and no problem, they're going to sort this out. And then the more the time passed by, there were things that I reacted. I thought, what is this? This is very strange. There were more and more lies coming up, obvious things that they said that didn't make sense. And then after a while, I started seeing parallels to like the Kennedy assassination and the other assassinations. And with the other assassination, it was I had made like a list, almost like a template of how to do it, because it followed, even though the circumstances were different for the different assassinations, there were very big similarities. So with the other assassinations, I had like point 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, how to do it and get away with it and trick people into believing the official version and then let it just disappear so that nobody would really notice what happened. And then I started seeing, oh my God, the Swedish assassination followed more or less exactly the same dots in this template. And that really freaked me out, because I was able to, predict things from looking at how the other assassinations were done. One time I said, within 2 weeks, the so-called investigation are going to come out and say this, blah, 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 blah. And within the next 2, 3 weeks, they did. Mm-hmm. And by then I knew, whoa, something is totally wrong here. And that was when I really started digging into this assassination.
Now, tell us a little bit about the book and how that came to be. And you obviously have been working on this for a long time. When was it published first time?
It has never been published.
Never published?
I put it up on the internet now for free, because for so many years I tried to get it published and no one has dared to touch it.
Okay.
I've had it with big publishers and they've just freaked out. I had it with Michael Moore's agent, and he said if you publish this, or whoever published this, will be sued from here to the moon. Mm-hmm. And he called it a truth bomb, a bomb of truth. And this is why this year I came to a point where I said the most important thing is that the truth gets out there. So I put it up for free to download from the internet. I'll just spread it really quick to take the pressure away from me, if you understand what I mean.
Sure, definitely.
And so it got spread around the world within hours. And I just checked now, this is like 2 weeks ago, and there's like 1,200 people who've downloaded it so far.
There should be more. We're going to do our best to get the word out, of course, because it's a very important message in the book. And what I like about it as well is that it dovetails with so many other events. We're going to get into this later, but I mean, it connects somewhat with the JFK assassination, if nothing else, in pattern. It goes into the Iran-Contra affair, the NATO situation in Sweden with their, you know, so-called neutrality and everything else. So it's very, very deep, you know, in its connections and tentacles. But the book was never published, you said, but how long have you been working on the book for? About
15 years.
Wow. Yeah. And did you, and during this time, have you continuously just worked on the book and updated it, or did you pretty much finish it and then try to just get it published a few years ago, or how did that work?
No, I tried to get it published while I was writing it as well, but then it came to a point, like, you know, you have interviewed a lot of people who are digging into the truth of what is going on globally. And so you are very aware of it. It's quite dangerous as well when you start digging too deep. And it came to a point the year 2000 when I had two friends of mine who died in strange ways. And I just felt, well, I need to go somewhere else. So that's why I moved to Spain. That's one of the main reasons. And when I came here, I finished the book here. That was I think I finished it in 2001 or something like that. And since then, more or less nothing has happened. So I haven't updated anything hardly. It's still the same version, more or less. Because the power elite behind this assassination have succeeded in getting people so tired of hearing about it, of all the different theories, and so nobody really cares anymore.
Yeah, it's true. We've seen this in the media. People get kind of tired of it, and they begin to make jokes about it, and it becomes another just conspiracy theory to throw away. But why don't we set the groundwork here a little bit, Ulla, for those who've never heard about either the murder or the prime minister itself. What would you like to say about Olof Palme and, I guess, the climate in Sweden at the time, and then later we can go into how things changed and everything. But let's talk about Palme a little bit first, and then obviously what happened, how he got killed, the official version at least.
Okay. The official version is that Olof Palme was a very just man, he was a protector of the weak, the poor. He was a man of the people, and he was a very controversial politician that were on an international level was sort of opening up doors to stop the big conflicts between the superpowers. He was also embracing like Castro and the many different of the smaller countries, and also like PLO and these different conflicts where no other international politician was welcome. The doors were open to him. That happened after in 68 that he stood up and went in a demonstration together with a Vietnamese ambassador in Stockholm. And they were demonstrating against the horror that the American army was doing in Vietnam and so on. That made him internationally well known as somebody who stood up for the weak people, sort of, so to say, up against the big bullies. I need to say, though, that the more you look into Olof Palme as a person, and when you look into his career and you look into what he was up to, what you see is a very double-faced person. You see one with the official version that as soon as the shots were fired that night and he died, he turned into a martyr of unlike proportions, like JFK. He got silver wings and a glow. You know, like it was like hallelujah.
Right. Yeah.
that had nothing to do with him before that, I would say. And I have quite a lot of theories about how that happened and what was going on there, because after he died, you were not allowed to raise any critical finger or point at anything, because then you were sort of harassing the dead,
right?
The dead, you know,
almost in favor of the murder if you criticize him for something.
Yeah, no, you cannot. Now it's changed a bit since so many years has passed on. But the thing is that once you start digging deeper into him, his career and background, it's a very, very, very strange background. He comes from a very upper class bourgeois family in Stockholm, very right wing. And he did his military duty and within the, I'm sorry about the English words. I'm not sure sometimes, because sometimes it's difficult with Swedish titles and so on to translate them.
No worries.
Anyway, I can say about what happened with the assassination of the official version. The official version is that the night of the assassination, Olof Palme and his wife, Lisbeth, they decided to go to the cinema. And they had said to the bodyguard that he didn't use his bodyguard very often, because up to the assassination, Sweden was a white island where no violence. It was like everything was wonderful and so on, contrary to other countries. And one of the things that amazed other people, other nationalities, was that the prime minister could walk around in the streets with no bodyguards, no threats, no nothing. Of course, that changed very much after the assassination. But up on that evening, when a few hours before they went to the cinema, he told his bodyguards that there was no need for them. So in the evening, he went to the cinema together with his wife and his son Morten and his girlfriend, and they went to central Stockholm. The Prime Minister, Olof Palme, he was living in the old town in Stockholm, so they walked to the subway station and took the subway into the central Stockholm, where they met his son, Morten, and then went to see a two-hour-long film. When that was finished, they decided to split up from his son and girlfriend, because they wanted to walk home to where they were living. And the Prime Minister and his wife decided to walk home. It's about a kilometer to where they lived in the old town. So they walked down Sveavägen, which is one of the main central streets in Stockholm. They walked down the street, and a few minutes before he was shot, a person was observed on a corner. There was an art shop called Dekorima. At that corner, this person who later shot him is said to have been standing waiting for them. And then when the couple came walking down the street, this guy, the shooter, he came up behind them, grabbed his left shoulder and fired off a shot right into the back of the Prime Minister, who dropped more or less dead at the very instant he hit the ground. His wife, Lisbeth, who was walking to the right of him, the official version says that she was pulled down when he fell, because they were in arms, sort of holding arms. So she was pulled down, and the shooter then tried to shoot her as well and fired a second shot at her that officially just touched her very, very lightly over her back. Then the shooter stood for a second or so, just checking that everything was the way it should be, that the Prime Minister was dead or dying, and then took off. He ran into the... there's a small little alley that he ran down, and then up some stairs. There's about almost 100 steps up, where he ran up, where he was seen by a few witnesses, and from there he disappeared. And the description of the hitman was the first description when you check out what the witnesses says, is that it was a man. He was about 35 to 40. Nobody saw his face. They saw that his head was a little smaller than normal to the body, like you see sometimes bodybuilders have, and that he was very fit and fast running. Mm-hmm. That he had a dark jacket going down to the knees or something like that, and most probably gray trousers, and some kind of cap or hat on. So nobody saw him at all, his face. No description was given out. Anyway, that is the official version, that he took off. Mm. Later, it is said that this was done by a lone crazy guy, and they blamed it. They even got a guy sentenced for the assassination. A man, his name was Christer Pettersson, and he was a local drunk, narcotic, with quite a lot of violent background. He had killed another guy on more or less on this very same spot, a few hundred meters from the site of the assassination. He had killed someone there with a knife some years earlier. And this guy was, they said that the reason why he shot Olof Palme was that he mistook him for his drug dealer. And that because they had the same fur cap, and he shot him by mistake and ran off. And that is more or less the official version to this day, that there was no reason, that it was all a mistake, and that it was done by this lone crazy guy called Christer Pettersson, who is now dead after being... Well, I can go get back to that.
Sure, definitely. No, but he's an interesting character, the way he comes along, and... He's a patsy, obviously. He's set up, and yet this is what we're being told to swallow. Where in this process do you begin to become suspicious? Is it during the when the official version of this is laid out, or is it later when the investigation is supposed to begin here? Where should we go next?
It is, Christer Pettersson is very, very late down the road. He's like 2 years after. He was not the first. They tried to pin this on several people before that. But if you are used to seeing and studying these kind of assassinations, it's very, very interesting to see how it's done. And one of the main things that you have to be aware of is that, like, for instance, if I go down to central Stockholm tonight, I pick up a brick and I throw it into a window. Within 2 minutes, I can guarantee you there will be police cars there. Mm-hmm. There will be, if I start making, or if I start shooting, there would be these combat squads. There would be police cars everywhere.
Yeah.
I would be grabbed and taken and boom, 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 within minutes. But when it comes to these big hits, when you know, this is the one of the signs that you know that there's a conspiracy behind it, is that nothing happens. All the normal procedure is out of place. You know, it's taken out. And this is exactly what happened that night. There's so many strange things happening within the first few hours. All of the witnesses I need to rewind a bit, because what the official version said, that it was a lone crazy guy that just walked up, shot him.
Mm.
But what the witnesses said was there was more than 100 observations of people with walkie-talkies. There were lots of observations of police cars that was officially not on duty that evening. There were witnesses who identified some of the people with walkie-talkie by name. And the whole setup with the... it's so complicated and complex, so it's not hard to... I'm not really sure where to begin.
I know we can detail this further, Ola, so we make sure we explain this to people. Obviously, what you're saying, first of all, here is that someone... And this is, as you said as well, recognized in other situations like this, someone in a position of power basically removes the normal level of protection that should be there during those circumstances, or the fact that someone in a position of power just basically removes the police that are supposed to be sent out or whatever.
Yeah.
Take us through a little bit more of this, of what actually happened. If we have obviously witnesses that are seeing all these weird things that are reported on. What happened with these? Because eventually these are kind of filtered out and we don't hear from this. What do you think happened, first of all, to these witnesses that might have been at an instant in the beginning that they were able to testify and tell their story, but they're later removed, right? They're not there to provide their testimony.
There's about, as far as I know, there's somewhere between 50 and 200 observations of walkie-talkies around the assassination site, down the streets, on parallel streets, around for the weeks before the assassination took place, outside the house where Olof Palme was standing, living.
Mm-hmm.
There were many, many people observing, like two, three people, outside in the street of where Olof Palme was living. They have been the description, everything has been given to the police. People saw them, they heard them speak a strange language. They was like English but with a German accent, or a strange, they couldn't really understand it. They were also around where the assassination took place a few hours later. Walkie-talkie people were observed, like they were checking out the site before how they were going to do it.
Mm.
They were when they went to the cinema, there were two people following them. Two of these people, of the walkie-talkie people, followed them. They were observed there by witnesses. They were observed on the subway train into Stockholm. And when they went into the cinema, there was one man placed outside the entrance. he goes under the name the Grand Man. Grand is the name of the cinema. And quite a few people saw him standing there with a bit of a nervous staring type of thing, because he was put there to make sure that the Prime Minister did not get out, you know, because this was the perfect, perfect evening for this to take place. Because by following him all the way from his home, then they knew for sure that he did not have a bodyguard with him, that he was on his own. And then when they entered the cinema, they knew for sure that he was going to be there for an hour and a half at least, meaning that everything could be prepared at the same time while they were in there.
Right.
So meanwhile, when the film is being played, there are observations of these, many of these different police cars. Many of it's both the official police cars and civilian police car with the technical equipment in the back seat and stuff like that. With some of them with fake number plates, you know, fake number plates because it's not the same at the front as in the back.
And, right. Mm.
And also they are standing very openly with their walkie-talkies communicating. And this is also a sign where you see with these other big assassinations that they know that they are covered. They don't fear that they will be taken by the local police, you know.
Right, right.
They know that they can get away, that they will be helped to get away. So they're very confident. There are no hiding.
I want to comment on this as well. To me, it's very interesting that it seems that it's actually a pretty, although it's well executed, it seems like they're not sure of what they're doing, that they're kind of fearful that this might not be pulled off, hence they have so many extra men on site and everything. It's similar to when you begin to investigate other false flag terrorism attacks and other assassinations as well, that there's like an overabundance of attention and people present just in case. So in one regard we could say that sure, it's a well pulled off assassination because they succeeded, but at the same time there seems to be a lot of insecurity about it as well. So when we begin to examine it, we can almost see that, wait a minute, maybe it's not so well thought out, or maybe it's not that incredibly well, it might be planned, but what I'm getting at is that they're very, very fearful that something potentially could go wrong. And if that's the case, then of course the whole cover would be blown on this thing, hence maybe that's why they have so many men in different positions, Ulla, so they can actually make sure that the job is done. But it looks really weird when people and witnesses are seeing all of this, you know?
But I don't agree with you at all there, because what is also standard with these big hits is that you have more than one operation going on at the same time, and they don't know about each other. So you have like 3-4 different operations. Often it can even be training things like in London and in 9/11 you had also, so these different operations going on at the same time, mm-hmm. meaning
yep.
that they're pointing at all different directions, so that when somebody like myself is trying to find out what is going on here, it's just pointing everywhere, and the people involved only know their own little part in it. They have no clear overview, so that you have all of these people involved in something that they don't really know what's going on. Mm-hmm. They only know their part. It's the need to know chain, as it's called. The CIA use it all the time. I know you, you know your sister, but I don't know anyone but myself, and so on.
It's a point well taken. It's a diversion, and no one really knows what's going on. And as you say, if one begins to investigate, you might find multiple layers of different people involved in different operations. And this is also part of the cover. I guess that's one of the points I wanted to make, that this is why, in some cases, eyewitnesses they're thrown off, because everything surrounding the situation is so weird and almost to the point of bizarre that they can't explain what's going on, basically.
And also it makes everybody sounds like they were crazy when you thought, yeah, but I saw this, I saw that.
Right.
I thought, yeah, come on, you know, be real. You've seen too much, you watch too many movies. But the thing is, the movies are often based on the real, not the other way around. the thing is that not even the people doing it are aware of the big whole scheme. You know, the people who shot him were just mechanics, you know, assassins. And when you look at the big assassinations like this and other political big hits as well, very, very often, if not always, the hit team have no idea where the order comes from, who ordered him dead. They have absolutely no idea. They just know their little part. They know that they got a description of the person they're going to hit. They might not even know that it's the prime minister. They don't know about the rest of the group. They have one contact or two. So it's often like a group of two or three people connected with radio. They're in the months before the hit or the weeks before, they're being moved between apartments and houses and safe houses, and they don't know about each other even. It's all organized from one central point where all the teams are sort of working together, where a small little group have an overview of the hit itself, and they don't even know where the order comes from. The people organize it, they just have been given the order and carry it out. So it's very, very complex. It's very hard to really get into finding the real truth. It's a lot easier to find out who the people were who carried out the assassination than finding out who ordered it.
Yeah.
And these are the guilty people. Not, they're a lot more guilty than the people who actually did it, in my opinion.
As you're saying, some of them might not even know what they were doing. I mean, that's guilt of itself, I guess, to a certain degree of being part of something you don't know what it is. But that's another story. Has anyone on the inside, as far as you know, actually talked about this, a police officer or someone who's been involved in a training exercise who knows that something weird is going on, but at least they know that they weren't part of the actual, or they were not the one who's obviously, you know, pulling the trigger in that sense, but they might have been part of something, yeah?
Yeah, quite a few people have been talking. The thing is also with the assassins or hitmen there, it's the people who are proud of what they did. You know, it was a historical hit. And then when you're proud, if you're not super, super, super professional, you start bragging, you know? You can't keep it to yourself. And when people get a little drunk, they start talking, and this is exactly what happened here with some of them, the people who were involved as well. So quite a few people have come forward and talked about their involvement. And it's by these people that when they get drunk or so and the rumors start flourishing about, oh, this guy was involved, that guy was involved, or they start talking about it openly because they also know that they will not be prosecuted or anything. These are the things, the jigsaw pieces that can give someone like me a possibility to start putting together a puzzle, getting a bigger picture. And for me, over the years, I had absolutely no idea about the magnitude of what I was getting into when I started. And it's been like making a jigsaw with a picture side downwards that I was sort of getting the pieces to fit together, but I had no idea about what the picture would be, if you understand me. It was first when certain parts of it was fitting together that I could turn it around and see the picture itself.
Do you want to give us a little hint of the picture that you've begun to formulate here and where the connection goes? I mean, obviously, we do want to get into detail about, you know, who did it, what the reasons were, how things have changed consequently and everything else. But what are some of the connections? What are some of the picture here, the picture that have emerged to you?
One of the ways that these big things are carried out is that you have a hit team, and it's more or less always put together by people. They're right-wing former policemen, security, soldiers, mercenaries, assassin, professional assassins. They're put together from different groups, different countries, different with no apparent connection between them. With the intention of making it as difficult as possible for someone to find out how it's connected. Yeah. So the hit team itself is put together like that of people who don't know where the order came from. Like I said, the order come from a very, very, very high position, because they are the only ones who can get away with this, because you need to control the justice system. You need to control key people in the media. You need to control key people in the justice system, in the police departments, all these places to get away with a thing like this. And also one standard component that is also always there is that the people who carry out the assassination have their own investigation on standby. So you have created a patsy before the hit, someone you're going to blame it on, and you prepared a lot of evidence and things that to point at this poor guy or group or whatever it is. Then the week before the assassination, you start pumping out in media that this group, they're really strange and they have weapons hidden, or it used to be they're like it's almost like there's fashion trends within the patsies. You know, it used to be that they pointed at Russians or East Bloc agents and stuff like that. Then after that, they started with now we have the Muslims. As soon as you're a Muslim, if your name is Muhammad and you have a dark mustache, great terrorist. You know, you can pump it. It needs to look good in media. And after now Muslims is getting a bit out of trend because people are getting more and more aware. So now they started doing it like more than Scandinavian looking. It could be one of our own.
That's right. Yep.
So now the next trend here is that it could be anyone.
Anyone is the terrorist. No one is
anyone.
Safe.
Anyone. And, yeah. And the whole point is with these actions is for us to beg for more control, you know?
Yeah.
It's the three-step rocket: problem, reaction, solution. It's the same one they pull off again and again and again.
That's
where
right.
The one in power creates a problem. Nobody knows that he is the one who created it. It could be a bomb, or 9/11, or Oklahoma City, or the Madrid bombing, or London, or whatever. They create a problem to create a reaction. So they pull off like a bomb in the middle of a city. You need to get a lot of good pictures out in media, like horrible pictures. It's no good with old guys or pensionists or something like that. No, children, nuns are one of the favorites. Nurses, great. You know, so that you can really get awful pictures out in the media to create a reaction from the public saying, oh my God, something needs to be done. And then they will come up and give you the solution saying, oh, but you have to understand to be able to stop a thing like this, we need to, and then they will come with their solution to the problem they created themselves.
That's right. It's like Sandy Hook and gun control. They're doing it.
It's
the same thing.
It's the same again and again. I don't even look into them anymore because it's sort of like, oh my God, here's another one.
Yep.
It's just standard. You can see it like they try. They say, let's see, that the plan is, I'm in power. I want the military to just be able to kick in anyone's doors. I want tanks in the streets. I want whatever. If I just put it there, if I was the prime minister and I just put it there in the streets, I would get a lot of reactions and problems with demonstrations and reactions from everywhere and criticism. So instead, I create this problem. A bomb somewhere, nicely done. I pump out in the media, ooh, this group over there, they're really weird. You know, it could be, who knows, maybe yogis or the bird lovers or something like that, you know, militant bird lovers, something stupid like that. They start pumping that in media and then boom, they pull it off, the bomb in a central city somewhere, point right away at this group of bird lovers, militant bird lovers, And so to get the reaction, and people say, oh my God, what, please help us. And I say, yeah, but the only way I can do that is by pulling in tanks in the street, by being able to kick in anyone's door, and so on. And people say, please do it, do it. And so in comes the tanks, in come whatever, boom.
The police take the surveillance cameras, anything they need
there
to.
There you go. Yeah. And they do it again and again and again and again. And all of these so-called school shootings or terror attack. I don't even know if there is such a thing as a real terrorist after all of these years.
Mm, yeah, I know.
I don't think so, you know, because every single time you can track it back to the same group again and again and again.
People are generally pretty peaceful, I think, and pretty calm unless something is really, really, you know, wrong somewhere. And
people are beautiful. They just want a normal, happy life with family and friends. It doesn't matter if you're in the middle of Tehran or if you're in downtown Stockholm or wherever. People are great. But there is a bully. There is a bully who's trying to mess it up for everyone.
That's right. And then you get Operation Gladio and things like that coming out of it. But let's go back a little bit more before we, you know, we're going to take a break here in a little while. But let's talk about the investigation some more and what happened there, because there's a lot of interesting people involved, and as you said before, even main investigative, you know, police chiefs and everything else have tried to figure out what actually happened. Mm-hmm. They've run into a cul-de-sac. They can't continue. They don't realize what's going on. They might be in a position of being a main investigator for a while, and then they're not involved in the case anymore. But again, the idea of the confusion, I think you explained it pretty well, that no one really knows what's going on, and even people in positions of power cannot get any straight answers from anybody mm-hmm. what's going on. So either that means that there's a lot of people involved that know what's going on and actively covering up, or as you said before, they are basically not in the know, but they know sufficiently enough what they should or shouldn't say so they can confuse people. But the investigation, what happened, and why haven't we found out more at this stage?
Do you know there's a reason why they killed people like Kennedy in an open street? Why they shot Palme in the open? It would be so easy to just drop a pill in their coffee or something like that if they just wanted them dead. But what they want is to send a shock of fear, a shock of terror in the corridors of power, saying that we can get anyone, anytime, anywhere. That's why they do it in the open, you know. And this is what has created this conspiracy of silence, you know, because very few people know the details, but they know the power behind these hits. And they also know that if they could take him, who am I? You know?
So they do it to silence people, send a message. Let's get into some of the other connections here as well. And what Palme was involved in at the time, as you said, he was very active on the international scene. He was almost more involved there in a certain stage than in the Swedish politics. And this dovetails with things like NATO, what was happening in Europe at the time, but also the weapons trade. Bofors, the big weapons manufacturer here in Sweden, was involved. It even connects in with Iran-Contra. Can you sort this out for us? What's going on here at the world at the time?
It's not easy.
It is not easy. Sorry about that.
But like I said, Olof Palme was a man that officially was standing up for the weak and the weak countries and so on. But at the same time, he was working for the big business, massive business. I'm sure you presented the Bilderberg Group and the Elite in many of your programs.
Sure.
Yeah, and also Olof Palme was a Bilderberg member. He was a member of the Committee of 300, who is trying to centralize the whole banking system and control the world. He was deeply, deeply involved in the building up of the Stay Behind in Sweden, the NATO's ghost army that was developed in all the different NATO countries, Western European countries. And at the same time, he was a man of the people, and it's quite confusing.
That's a contradiction, exactly. Well, let's talk about that a little bit.
It's a total total contradiction. But I would, there was a lot of people suspecting that he was like a double agent, and I would say it, he was at least that, because the official version of this taking, you know, opening the arms for all the poor and the defenseless and so on, that was one thing. But he was using that to open the doors to countries like Cuba, opening the doors to PLO and other countries like that. At the same time, that he was all the time working for the power elite, the money, big money. And at the time of his death, he was deeply involved in a weapons transaction with India that he pulled off, mm-hmm. where it was, I can't remember it was like the biggest arms deal ever. And please remember, Sweden is supposed to be a neutral country.
Yep.
A neutral country. We're not talking like England or France where you can say, okay, fine, if you want to be part of a war, no problem. But Sweden is neutral. But we have this weapons factory called Bofors that... It has come out over the years that they've been involved in a lot of illegal trading where Sweden manufactured weapons but sold them to so-called green countries. Mm-hmm. They were unofficially labeled green and red countries. The green countries were countries that was not at war, where the weapons were just used as for defense and so on. But the real buyers were so-called red countries, which were countries like Iran, Iraq, all of these other countries that was at war with other people. And what Bofors did was that they sent the weapons to a green country. In the green country, the papers were switched. So because the first green country was allowed to sell to another green country, and then it went to another green country and bump from country to country until it came to one where they could send it to
a
so-called red country.
Yeah.
So it was mostly paperwork, because the money went straight, the weapons went straight to these
red listed countries. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And we're talking about massive amounts of money. And many people involved, many people involved as well, and big bribes.
And there's been scandal after scandal, by the way, as well, of these bribes people in Sweden who are, you know, members of the board of Bofors and other companies as well, ABB, and it goes on and on from there. Yeah.
And many people have died around that as well.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, being taken out one by one, all the key people are dead. And also Rajiv Gandhi, who he made this arms deal with, he was killed as well. So it's a dangerous business to get into.
Indeed, and I just wanted to comment and say this as well, that this is, after all, good old Swedish tradition, I think. If we go back to the Second World War, Sweden, and specifically the Wallenberg family, who were mm-hmm. owned the SKF, the ball bearing factory at the time, I mean, they were selling it to both sides of the war. They literally... were keeping the wheels of the war running during the Second World War.
Yeah, for sure. I would say when we come to Sweden, there's a massive dose of double morals. You know, like they don't. It's not a country with a clean conscience.
No, that's for sure. Now, in a little while here, we're going to take a break. I want to get into the next segment here. I want to get into a little bit more about. The deeper connections, obviously, of who is the spider in the web, what your theory about that is, and there is a lot of connections more that we haven't got to yet. I want to ask you about propaganda due down in Italy and the connections with the old man George Bush and everything as well. So it just goes on and on from there. But let's give out some details about the book and where people can go to find it, Ulla. Let's give out your websites and basically just tell people where to go when they want to read the book and pick up more information about yourself. So please go ahead and mention all the things to get that out there.
Okay. One of my websites is www.oledammergaard.com. That's OLEDAMMEGARD.com. And this book is called Coup d'etat in slow motion. Coup d'etat in slow motion, because that is truly what I believe happened. It was not just an ordinary murder, but a coup d'etat in slow motion that took place over a long time so that nobody really noticed what was going on. It started with the shots at Svea Wegen, but it continued to over the years, and now the country, Sweden, is so different to what it was before the assassination. Anyway, on that site, I've got I'm quite multifaceted, so I got many of my different things on that website. And also, I put the book there to download for free with a donation button if anybody would like to support me, because that would be very appreciated. But it's there to be downloaded for free, both in English and Swedish, because I believe that the main thing is that the truth gets out there.
All right, very good. We're going to obviously have the website linked up as well. So in case you have a little bit difficult spelling Ulla's name, we'll have that up there for you. So check out redaspirations.com and just go there and you'll have the link. And then also, by the way, as Ulla said, go ahead and download the book, read it. And if you enjoy it, if you like what you're reading and appreciate some of the connections that are made in the book, and there are a lot of them, by the way, as well. I want to mention that again, 800 pages. Do go ahead and support Ulla in his work so that he can continue and, of course, feel some appreciation for all the hard work that he has done for the book as well. And it's excellent. Yeah, go ahead.
Can I just say also that don't swallow what you read, you know, without criticism. Do not do that. Check it out. Read it. Make up your own opinion. Check it out yourself. Make your own investigations and then see what comes up. And if you see what you read in the book and if you find that as being the truth, then please spread it.
Very good. Stay with us, Ulla. We'll take a short break here. We'll be right back with more.